KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in East Oakland.
Cleveland Heights.
I live in Adams Point.
West Oakland.
I live in San Leandro now.
Upbeat.
Coming up, we'll hear about newly uncovered videos from the ghost ship warehouse.
It was also important to note that in a couple of the cases, the officers themselves said, hey, we need to shut this place down. We're coming here too often. This is becoming a problem for us.
Then we continue our series of interviews with San Francisco mayoral candidates. Today, Angela Alioto.
I don't think I've ever seen San Francisco in a worse shape. And so I decided to run for mayor.
And we'll hear how a modern boogie funk group reps the Bay Area's diversity.
You know, the Pendletons, when we're up on stage, we have a lot of different faces up there and a lot of different people that kind of represent everybody.
That's coming up next on Cross Currents. Welcome back to Cross Currents from KALW News. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area. I'm Hannah Baba. It's been a year and a half since the fire at the Ghost Ship Warehouse in East Oakland that killed 36 partygoers, and new information about the tragedy is still coming out. Late last month, East Bay Times writers David DeBolt and Matthias Gaffney published an article on the trove of police body camera videos they uncovered. These videos show what Oakland police knew about the warehouse before the fire and what happened the night of the fire. The East Bay Times won a Pulitzer Prize last year for their coverage of the Ghost Ship fire, and David DeBolt was part of that reporting team. DeBolt joined KALW's Jeremy Dalmas in studio to talk about these new videos and about litigation around who's to blame for the 36 deaths.
So the East Bay Times was able to get more than a dozen videos from police body cameras. These are videos that the public has never seen before, right? What's in them?
Yes, we were able to get through a source about a dozen sets of videos that show police responding to the ghost ship in the 2+ years before the fire. You have everything from being called there to settle, you know, disputes between tenants. There's a stabbing there. Two officers were called there by someone who was concerned that the children were living inside the ghost ship, that being Derek Almeida's kids. What they show us is this raw video of the officers walking inside, using the makeshift staircase, one officer questioning the dangers they're seeing around them. They go on all levels of the ghost ship, from the first floor to the second floor. They even get up on the roof in one case to save a man who was threatening to jump off the roof,
oh, wow.
Which was a pretty heroic rescue. But so they saw, you know, every nook and cranny of that warehouse, which we now know, you know, was obviously a danger to its residents and attendees.
Yeah, and so there's a series of videos from before the fire, and there's a series of videos the night of the fire as well, right?
Yes, and I should say this is hours and hours of footage that me and Matthias reviewed. Some of the most shocking stuff was, the night of the fire, where, you know, you can see in the videos the fire is still raging. You know, people are huddled in the Wendy's parking lot across the street with Red Cross blankets. The officers are trying to get sort of a sense of the magnitude of the fire. You can hear them in the videos listing names of the missing, who we now know, you know, are among the dead. They're comforting relatives, you know, trying to get them to cling, you know, to some hope. But as they're going through the list, you can hear the voice in the officers just drop. They're realizing that, you know, this is a great tragedy, one that Oakland hasn't seen before.
Yeah. There's, like you said, hours of footage. I imagine you spent a lot of time going through it all. And I'm curious what parts really stood out to you.
Yeah, for us, it was the parts where, you know, police were walking inside the ghost ship. They were there a lot, not always welcomed them in, but, you know, I found on at least 7 occasions they had went inside and, you know, had full view, even in the daytime, of what it looked like in there. It was also important to note that in a couple of the cases, the officers themselves said, hey, we need to shut this place down. We're coming here too often. This is becoming a problem for us. And it's now become clear through this, you know, latest dump of videos that more than one officer was there more than one time, and they were well acquainted with the building and with Derek Almeida, the master tenant.
It's been about a year and a half since the fire, and I'm curious what these videos show that the public might not already know.
We have reported a lot about the visits, but I think it kind of brings to life what, you know, and we're able to see for ourselves now what the officers saw when they walked in there. We've been reporting from the get-go about, you know, the numerous visits by police and fire. But I think this just gives a clear view of what the cops saw you know, on the multiple visits at the ghost ship. This wasn't some, you know, some secret place or a mystery. You know, this was on the city's radar. To be fair, police officers they're not firefighters, they're not building inspectors. They at that time did not have a policy where they even had to report these things to building or fire. They've now since changed that policy in the wake of Ghost Ship. But I mean, it just shows that perhaps there's a need for law enforcement to be, you know, a little more aware of what they're seeing when they're going on these calls. That, you know, all it would have taken was an email to a, you know, fire official or the building department, say, hey, I think you guys should take a look at this place. Because ultimately, you know, from the building to fire to police, they're all saying, hey, we didn't know about this, or this wasn't our job to enforce this. And so whose job was it? You know, and I think these videos show that the police knew what was going on in there. And in one case, one officer said one spark and it will, you know, be all bad. It's like a huge fireplace in here. So he was noting the fire dangers. And I will also add, it's unfortunate that firefighters, they're not equipped with body cameras, because we can't see what they saw. They had been there on at least three occasions we know of, but there's no footage of that. So, you know, we can't say with certainty what they saw when they were going inside the building.
I understand it wasn't easy getting access to these videos. Can you tell me about that?
So it took us about a little more than a year to get all the ones we had requested from the city. But what we didn't realize was there's a lot more videos that, you know, and I learned from a source who was like, oh, no, there's a lot more you guys don't have. And I just requested it, and that person handed them over to us. And that resulted in our review of, like I said, hours and hours. I myself must have watched like 10 hours of footage.
I'm curious, with all these new videos, what that means maybe for the city and possible litigation? Because like, the videos show the police knew the people lived there, that they had parties there, the police knew that it was unsafe. What could that mean for the city of Oakland?
Well, I mean, all those allegations are included in the claim or in the lawsuit filed against the city. This is a lawsuit that's been filed on behalf of the victims' families and also some former tenants who lived at Ghost Ship. It's filed against the city of Oakland, PG&E, Chor Ng, the landlord, Derek Almina, and a host of other people who were involved in promoting the party that night. This is what they call a complex litigation case because it involves so many parties. So they've all been moved into one massive lawsuit. And in that suit, they make all these claims. That's kind of it's essential to the lawsuit that the city knew, and they didn't do anything about it.
So Derek Almena and Max Harris are two men who lived at the warehouse, and they're the only two people who are facing criminal charges right now. Could these videos affect those cases at all?
You know, could. I mean, their attorneys, after reading our stories, said, hey, look, this shows the city knew and they didn't do anything and that they approved of this place. Tony Serra, who represents Derek, is saying this is further proof that the city of Oakland greenlighted this and gave the impression to my client that this was okay. I don't know if it'll have an effect on a jury or not. I guess we'll have to wait and see. They're each facing 36 counts of involuntary manslaughter, and the judges refused to reduce their bail, so they're still in custody.
So there's Chor Ng, who's the owner of the building, and she could face criminal charges, right? But she hasn't yet. That's a potential.
The DA's office did look into or have discussions about charging Chor and her two kids, Kai Ng and Eva Ng. They sort of had more involvement with the warehouse. Kai was sort of the manager there. Eva collected rent. What we're told right now is that from DA O'Malley, the district attorney, that there's a degree of separation between the Ng family and the warehouse. They weren't the ones who were installing the illegal transformer, which was used there, and all the other unpermitted work that went on at Ghost Ship. There is an argument, I think, that at least Kai Ng knew about this. There are emails we've obtained that shows that he knew about the unpermitted work. He approved of it. He even sent an invoice to Derek and Max about one of the installations of a transformer. The DA has not sort of gone into great detail explaining her decision-making in this process, but they do say they're still continuing to review it. But it doesn't look likely at this point.
Well, thank you so much for coming in and talking with us, David.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That was KALW's Jeremy Dalmas speaking with East Bay Times reporter David DeBolt. For more coverage of the Ghost Ship fire, go to our website, kalw.org, click Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KELW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Angela Alioto has been involved with politics in San Francisco for longer than she's been a politician. That's because her father, Joseph Alioto, was the city's mayor 50 years ago. Alioto has had a distinguished career in elected office herself. She served on the Board of Supervisors in the 90s and was president of the board for a few years. Now she wants to be mayor. Here's her one-minute pitch.
I am running for mayor of San Francisco because of the state of the city, from the disgraceful amount of poor people living on our streets to the filthiness of our streets to seriously addicted people literally dying in our streets when they should be in rehab and not be allowed to just sit there while we walk by. It's not a third world, and it's being treated that way. Nobody can afford to live here. Affordable prices are starting at $130,000 salary. That's not affordable. We need to keep our teachers, our police, and our fire, and our emergency services, and nurses here in town, and they just can't afford to live here. I don't think I've ever seen San Francisco in a worse shape. And so I decided to run for mayor when I really hadn't intended to.
That's San Francisco mayoral candidate Angela Alioto. She sat down with KLW's Ben Trefney to talk more about her candidacy. Here's an excerpt from that conversation.
So you mentioned toxins in some building sites and Hunters Point Shipyard,
right?
Of course, there's a lot of controversy about what's happening there with soil samples taken on some parcels there that were found to be falsified. This is a former Superfund site, and it's a location where Lennar Corporation is building 12,000 housing units overall. And as mayor, what do you plan to do about this scandal?
Well, you know, we were just talking about who hires who, and I said I would never trust the defense in their experts. The city needs to have their own person tell them exactly what these toxins are. I get that the Navy has a duty and obligation pursuant to their contract of sale. I get that. But having said that, when they come back with something that turns out to be fraudulent, the first thing you do is send them a bill for your guy, for your engineers to come in and tell us really and truly what's going on here. And the problem with that, as with so much more in politics, is a form of, you know, this pay-for-play stuff that's going on at City Hall. It's pretty amazing.
What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, you're going to get something if you pay for it. And there have been big players in that for many years in San Francisco now. And my candidacy basically stops that, which is why I'm so opposed. But you know, you're going to get a toxic report that's either legitimate for the city or legitimate for the builders in the city that want it built, as opposed to the Navy, who still has an obligation to give you a clean bill of health and had to fraudulently give us a report because they were obligated to give us a report.
When you talk about pay for play, I mean, you're a lawyer, of course, and so an allegation like that is pretty severe, but you also have been involved with city politics for a very, very long time. What would you do about that? Because a lot of people think about corruption in City Hall, but there's not a lot of names named necessarily.
Oh, there actually has been in history. What I would do about it, I would stop it.
How?
Let me give you an example. I wrote the first smoking ban, okay, in the United States of America, and I banned smoking in the workplace. And when I did that, I had all sorts of fights because Willie Brown on the state level had given immunity to the tobacco industry, immunity to an industry that swore it was not addictive, and yet they knew very well it was addictive and killing people. And on a napkin at a restaurant, while everybody's enjoying lunch, they sign a document that the state of California can't sue the tobacco industry. Absolutely unconscionable. You know, Willie's famous for that kind of stuff. I had to fight them, and we won. You know what you do? You call people on the carpet. You embarrass them. You shame them. I'm doing that right now with an ordinance concerning the sanctuary law that I wrote. You know, you call them on the carpet going, what are you doing? The citizens of San Francisco don't want this. Why are you doing it? You shame them.
Would you want to shake up City Hall in ways? So do you see corruption kind of infiltrating at different levels because of, say, I mean, you mentioned Willie Brown. I think that there's a lot of Willie Brown's legacy that's within City Hall.
Yeah.
How would you go about addressing that?
Well, on the whole mayor's race, during the whole campaign, I have said I would let go three or four of the very big department heads. The head of MTA and the department of DPW and Park and Rec need to get their resumes ready. I believe what they've done, they're like kings of kingdoms. People don't even know what they're doing, and they're absolutely running the city into the ground. I mean, you know, I've discovered sole source contracts based on, contracts based on a sole source exemption to redo a street 10 times because the money is still in the contract with a subcontractor that is totally corrupt. And that money can be so used in better places. Moreover, a sole source contract, let's say you want a painting. When you give a sole source contract without a competitive bid such that the efficiency is higher, the lack of efficiency is higher and the price is lower, you're going to end up, you have to have a Picasso. In other words, this person has to be a sole source exemption. If you want a painting, it's got to be Picasso or Leonardo himself, okay? It isn't some company that digs a hole in the ground and paves the street. There are a lot of companies, nobody doing contracts in our city should have a sole source exemption when it comes to MTA or DPW, period, period.
Having stated that, with some of the powers that be in city politics, mm-hmm. do you think that affects your chances to become mayor?
I think the people of San Francisco absolutely love it. They absolutely, because who has the guts to say DPW's got to find a new job? I'm in this because I love San Francisco. I'm not in this to make people have a better salary at the highest levels. Do you know that the head of DPW makes over $405,000 a year?
I see a lot of salaries in city government that are extraordinarily high.
It's boggling.
We're speaking with Angela Alioto. She's a candidate for mayor of San Francisco. So I have a lightning round. What do you think about the use of tasers in policing?
I think police officers should have the alternative of a taser.
Legalized adult use recreational marijuana, is that good or bad?
I think it can be good in some places and bad in others. For example, the Chinese community doesn't want it. And if that community doesn't want it anywhere near them, I think they should have that choice.
Charter schools versus conventional schools in the public school system.
Conventional.
Why?
Because if someone would care about our conventional district schools, they would be wonderful.
The Golden State Warriors coming to San Francisco.
Love it. I'm a fan. I did the legislation that built the Giants. We were going to lose them to Pittsburgh, to St. Petersburg in Florida. And I'm a fan. And people should remember that the Warriors were San Francisco Warriors before they became Golden State.
That's true. They played right over the hill
they
here
sure
at the
did.
Cal Palace.
They sure did.
What do you think about the Central Subway?
I think it's just a shame. It needs to go all the way down to Fisherman's Wharf. I mean, what is that about, stopping in Chinatown? I mean, really, what is that about?
What do you think of how Mid-Market Street changed during the Lee administration?
Ed Lee was a really good friend of mine. And if you knew Ed Lee, you'd know that a lot that happened wasn't really in the heart and soul of Ed Lee. That's just my personal opinion.
Do you like how Mid-Market Street changed?
No, I think that it's... Look, there was a real recession. I get that. And we absolutely need to invigorate the city. I also get that. Again, nobody sat down and made out a plan. And the concept of giving billionaires a tax incentive is like, did you give that to the small businesses? Did you help small businesses in any way? Small businesses are absolutely inundated with several different taxes, okay? Why? It's just horrible. I'm really upset about what's happened to small businesses. So when the tech came to town, there wasn't a plan. So I think it could have been done in a little smoother way and not so all at once. But it is what it is, and we have time to stop anything that is, harming our city, which is what I'm doing.
What do you hate most about San Francisco?
The congestion. The traffic congestion's out of control.
What do you love most about San Francisco?
Oh, come on, it's iconic. It's my city. You know what I mean? It's San Francisco's iconic. You can travel around the world and not leave San Francisco.
That's San Francisco mayoral candidate Angela Alioto speaking with KELW's Ben Trefney. That was part of their conversation. She also talked about climate change.
I am a real fanatic about bringing in experts.
Policing.
Whether they're on the street, on a bike, you know, on a motorcycle or on a horse. We need more police officers on the street.
And the state of San Francisco politics.
Nobody talks to anybody anymore. There are no coalitions. Everybody hates each other. It's stunning.
You can hear that entire conversation and all our conversations with all of the mayoral candidates at KALW.org. Click Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hena Baba. Eight years ago, and have been keeping the 80s boogie sound alive ever since. Their latest vinyl release, called Funk Forever, is a jazzy five-track EP that mixes old-school vibes with soulful lyrics. In this edition of Bay Area Beats, the Pendletons share their musical influences, including San Francisco's Sweater Funk Party.
We had been struggling to figure out what we were going to call ourselves. We didn't know. And I walked into Crossroads and there was a Pendleton shirt. And I remember walking out of the store in Upper Hay going, ah, the Pendletons. And at that moment, I text Dan and I was like, the Pendletons. And he was like, yeah, that's it. Hey, my name's Eric, a.k.a. DJ E, the boss of the Pendletons.
My name is Dan, a.k.a. Trailer Limone. With the Pendletons. I guess modern funk really is the blanket sort of term for this kind of music.
What's different than what we do from a lot of other people that do this music is we have a heavy hip-hop influence in it. And in the Funk Forever EP, you can see like a lot more influences from jazz. You know, we got a lot more horns involved this time.
We got this live interaction. We had a live drummer, bassist, keyboard player, and they kind of were, you know, able to sort of play off each other. Eric has like a crazy collection of obscure music. He'll bring a lot of times cuts as an inspiration, you know what I mean?
Yeah, a couple of the songs that I used were Ozone, Our Hearts Will Always Shine, and Lionel Richie, Love Will Find a Way. I would just take a four-bar loop and then ask them to give us a different take on that.
And then we built the song through that and added a bunch of layers and wrote our lyrics. I keep living, just won't give it, there's no guarantee. When we first started out, we were doing a little bit more beat culture oriented stuff too. That was actually, I mean, it was cool stuff, but it kind of didn't pan out to the point that we wanted to put it on record necessarily. So then we made the record, our first record, which was Waiting on You Coming Down, and it really kind of hit. Like a lot of people really liked it. So we started to kind of lean more in that boogie direction.
There was a huge resurgence of this music because it was the DJs that were playing it in the clubs to the masses. So Sweater Funk, it's a party in San Francisco that happens every week on a Sunday night in the Mission District at the Knockout. I had the test presses and I just walked down to Sweater Funk one night and I was like, you know, if you like it, play it. I mean, that moment changed everything for us because that record from that point immediately took off.
It was just a cool combo, man. They really created a really good springboard atmosphere for our music.
That party, they really, really honed in on the really underground side of that music. All the music that I grew up listening to, riding around in my mom's car when I was like 10 years old in Newark, New Jersey, like listening to the radio. We can fly over the sky.
So I grew up in the Bay Area, and my dad was super into Tower of Power, so we played that a lot in my youth. Bump City in particular, I remember hearing that a lot when we were on road trips because we had it on a cassette tape. So we just always bump this album, and it was just so lively. Not only did they have just amazing music, but there was also that diversity of the Bay Area, and I was like, oh, there's a white guy in the band, there's a Latino dude in the band, there's African American influence too. It just felt like we can all party together. You know, the Pendletons, when we're up on stage, we have a lot of different faces up there and a lot of different people that kind of represent everybody. If people want to see that. To me, that's kind of what funk is about. You know, funk is about that inclusivity, that diversity, and just being able to go to a party and really lose yourself.
For me, I want people to listen to it anytime as long as they're having a good time.
The Pendletons' latest EP is called Funk Forever. That piece was produced by KALW's Marisol Medina Cadena. And that's our show. Today's Cross Currents team includes Raquel Maria Dillon, Janae Darden, Nina Gensler Debs, Angela Johnston, Lisa Morehouse, Christine Nguyen, True Quinn, Lilia Vega, and Josh Wilson. Our engineers are James Rollins, Gabe Graben, and Jackie Sajiko. The line producer is Hannah Kingsley Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.